Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Today's two authors are both members of the North State Writers Club, and they have stories of mystery and suspense, true and fictional. Later in the hour, I'll be talking to retired English teacher Kathy Chase, who'll be signing copies of her novel, Jump, at the Chico State Bookstore a week from tomorrow on October 8th. The Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture has just opened in Washington, D.C. Chico's own photographer and author, Douglas Keister, has had 60 of his photographs selected for inclusion in this new museum. Doug grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and in the mid-1960s acquired over 250 negatives of Lincoln places and people, mostly African-American. He saved them over the years as he went on to become a professional photographer and author of books on cemeteries and architecture and a memoir about growing up in the heartland of America. In its series, Images of America, Arcadia Publishing collected Doug's photographs in a book, Lincoln in Black and White, 1910 to 1925. Douglas Keister, welcome.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
I feel like I should say, welcome, Sherlock Holmes, because that's really what you did in compiling this book that you put together and the exhibit for Washington.
Right. It's been a 50-year, that's 50, half-century journey between when I discovered these photographs and now that they're to the Smithsonian.
So, in other words, you're a young kid.
I was a baby when they were found. No, I was a teenager in high school when they were found.
But you were already interested in photography at the time.
Right. A friend of mine was an antique collector, and I was a budding photographer, and he went to the equivalent of a garage sale and purchased these big stack of glass negatives. And subsequently sold them to me so I could practice. You know, that way I didn't have to take photos. I really liked the darkroom process and because it was kind of magic to me.
And so this guy says, here, Doug, you're interested in photography. What about these plates, these glass plates?
Right, right. And for those that don't know, a glass plate is the same as a glass, you know, a film. It's the same thing, it's just on glass. And that's what they used to use a lot of 100 years ago. And he got these and he had been told, this guy, his name was Doug Boylson. He collected phonographs and the old wind-up Edison phonographs. And he was told by somebody that in these stack of plates was a picture of a little girl on a phonograph. So he bought them kind of without even knowing that. With the trust that it would be there. And sure enough, one of the pictures that I found in the stack of negatives was a little girl and a photograph, an African-American girl.
With a phonograph.
Yes, phonograph, yeah.
And the fact that they're glass really astounds me because when I was growing up, my parents had a record collection of these, before vinyl was invented, these records that were very fragile. They weren't glass, but I don't think any of those records survived at the time us kids played with them. And so it's amazing that all these plates survived.
It is, because they were literally stacked up in, they were 5 inches by 7 inches, and they were stacked up in shoeboxes. And so, no particular care went into their preservation. As a matter of fact, like a negative, once your parents may have taken the picture or you took a picture, you're kind of done with that negative. You kind of threw it in a box somewhere. Really wasn't intended to ever be printed again. Rarely did that happen. So these were just stacked up in somebody's garage.
And you had no clue as to their provenance. You didn't know who these people were.
No.
Did you have any clue? How do you even begin? Or were you even curious who these people were?
anybody that knows me, I've been
curious. You're curious about everything.
I've been curious about everything. And
in fact, how many books have you written? To date?
Yeah, 44.
44 books you've written because you become interested in something and off you go.
Off I go. I've got three more in the works. So,
so. You're going to be getting to 50 novels and books on history, architecture. Yeah. Anyway, so
kids.
This story, then, you're curious about who the heck are these people?
So some of the first pictures, I mean, I could tell, even though it's a negative, you know, kind of what it was, some of the first pictures I could tell what they were buildings in like in Nebraska. And some of them were construction photos of buildings downtown. So with the aid of, you know, some historians in Lincoln, we were able to date the pictures. Because a building picture, boy, that's, you know, that's a really good timestamp. And also, you know, the style of dress and things like that. So we were able to date the photographs from about 1910 to 1925.
So that's what's on the cover of your book, this edition of Images of America, Lincoln in Black and White, 1910 to 1925. So that's how you're able, by looking at these construction sites,
right.
photographs of the construction, you say, okay, here's when this was early 20th century.
Right. And also, you know, I didn't pay much attention to the pictures of people. For one thing, they were negative, so it wasn't that easy to tell. But I could tell that they were a mixture of African Americans and also white people. But it was the pictures of people were kind of like when you go to the antique store and you see these bins of old photographs. You're curious for a minute, but they're not your relatives. You know, nobody you know. So you just kind of set them aside.
It seems that represented in the photographs that the black population was more represented than they were in the general population of Lincoln, Nebraska.
Right. That was really interesting. Why were there so many African Americans? So
in the photographs, and not in the general population.
Yeah, the general
of Lincoln,
population
Nebraska.
Maybe 5%. So, but these were, you know, maybe 90% in the photographs. But you know, once again, we didn't. You know, there wasn't much curiosity about that. I was a budding photographer. I kind of moved on to other things, and nothing. They were set aside. The glass negatives for about 30 years.
My guest is Douglas Keister, and he has a collection of photographs, and he's been telling us how he acquired this collection of negative, these plates, and he collected them in a book called Lincoln, referring to Lincoln, Nebraska, in black and white, and 60 of his photographs have been selected for inclusion in the new National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. So these photographs sit in your childhood home in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Right.
You go off to California. And so how did you even who was it that said, hey, Doug?
Well, yeah. Eventually, the negatives did make it to California. On a trip back to Nebraska, I picked them up and took them back. They weigh about 50 pounds. I mean, there's no small thing. But in 1999, somebody in Lincoln, Nebraska, was doing research on the African-American neighborhood, and they discovered 36 glass negatives in somebody's closet. The Historical Society got wind of that. They looked at the negatives and determined they weren't anything ordinary at all. They were extraordinary photographs. And the Lincoln, Nebraska paper, the Lincoln Journal Star, did an article on.
But you're here in California.
I'm in
you
California.
You don't read the Lincoln paper, do
I don't
you?
Read, no, my mother does, though. So my mother saw the article, clipped it out, sent it to me in California, just with a little note going, don't you have some old glass negatives? Not even associating what was in the paper with what I had. I looked at the four or five pictures in the paper, and I went, the backgrounds look similar. And sure enough, I got in touch with some historians in Lincoln, and they verified that what I had were the same, taken by the same hand, you know, the same background, the same style. And then shortly thereafter, the Historical Society proclaimed that the pictures I had were a state treasure.
I mean, well, you even thank your eagle-eyed mother.
Yeah, mother. Yeah, if it wasn't for my mother reading the paper and taking the time to clip out that article, none of this would have ever happened.
Probably would have been still sitting in your closet,
yeah,
stacked up there, forgotten.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that has happened with a lot of other things. With, you know, other people have. They don't know. And until there is a seminal moment, they just sit there. But this was the seminal moment.
So with this article, you find out, oh, maybe I've got something here, but you still don't know anything about it. So how do you go about tracking down any of these people in these photographs?
Well, I really have to thank the city historian, a guy by the name of Ed Zimmer.
In fact, his name is also on the cover of this book, Images of America, Lincoln in Black and White, your name and his name, because he is in Lincoln.
Yes.
And is a historian.
He is a historian for Lincoln. He's also on other commissions. He works for the city government. But he is even more of a know-it-all than I am. It's hard to believe. And once he sinks his teeth into something, he has to find out. And he and his staff started interviewing people in the African-American community, trying to find out, you know, does anybody recognize this picture? And sure enough, after a couple years, actually, of looking, he identified the actual photographer. A woman by the name of Foley saw one of the pictures that Ed showed her and said, "Johnny Johnson took our picture." And sure enough, more things started getting revealed, and we discovered that an African-American photographer who was the son of a Civil War veteran took the photographs. And all I can tell you is, that was a revelation. And when that happened, you know, more people started coming forward and identifying the pictures. And the Smithsonian, somebody at the Smithsonian actually got an early preview of them, a guy named Lonnie Bunch, who later became the director of the new African-American Museum.
And he's doing the publicity now for the museum, Lonnie Bunch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lonnie Bunch. Him seeing them back in 1999.
Which was a stroke of luck for you.
Right, right.
Because no matter how important these photographs are, you've got to get somebody's attention who's in a position of authority to make the decision to say, yeah, we want this in our museum.
Right, yeah. Lonnie Bunch was the guy, and he saw them in 1999. And even though he was at the Smithsonian American History Museum and then went to another museum in Chicago, he remembered these. And so it was a really, really long process, a decade long, more than that, of continuing to research, continuing to get little magazine articles here and there, and just little snippets of information until 2012, when Paul Zing, the president of Chico State, Trey Robinson, who was the director of diversity and inclusion, and Joel Zimmelman at the Dean of Humanities pooled their resources to make large-scale prints of about 36 of the negatives, and we had to show at Chico State.
I had the pleasure of seeing that exhibit, and it was absolutely fascinating. I could have spent an hour in front of each photograph just taking in every detail.
I've been told it was one of the most successful and well-attended shows at Chico State in recent history. I would go, of course, went more than once. And people would just be standing there looking at these large-scale blow-ups. I mean, originally the pictures would have been just 5 inches by 7 inches, but by having the original negatives, we were able to blow them up to 30 inches by 40 inches, 40 inches by 60 inches, and people would stand there. And a couple of people commented to me that it was like walking into these people's lives. And so it was just a fascinating thing to watch. And there, after the show closed, a few years later, an organization called Exhibit Envoy has taken on the show, and it's opening in Houston.
You're taking your show on the road,
yes,
so to speak.
Yeah. And at the end of our 16, a double run in Houston and at the end of the year. And also, the Smithsonian got in touch with me after the Chico State show, and that started a whole nother process.
Well, since this is radio and we can't show on the radio these photographs, I'd like you to describe the photograph that's on the cover. Remind people, my guest is Douglas Keister. He is a photographer and prolific author, and we're talking about his book, Lincoln, Nebraska, in Black and White, 1910 to 1925. And this photograph on your cover, it looks like a family, maybe a father and mother, three children. What did you find out about this, I'm going to call them a family, were they?
It was actually two families. It was the Colleys and the Malones, and they became very influential in the Urban League, became Other family members, I moved to California. These were, obviously people can't see this picture, but these are people.
They're nicely dressed, fashionably dressed, tastefully dressed.
Smiling. Yes. It's a well-posed, well-lit photograph. It speaks volumes about what was called at the time the New Negro Movement, which was to elevate and uplift the status of African Americans in America. If there is a photograph that typifies that, it's this photograph on the cover. Although these people have very humble lives. You know, they're cooks, they're draymen, they're just janitors, but they are dressed to the nines.
Well, now your title is Black and White because most of the faces are black. You also have white people in there, but this photograph itself is not black and white, and that's what I would expect it to be, black and white. What color would you call that?
That's a sepia color,
yeah.
Which was more of the style of the times, kind of a yellowish brown. One of the things I'd also like to point out, we did call it, Lincoln in Black and White, because there in my collection are a number of white people, because the neighborhood that most, not all, but most of the photographs were taken was an integrated neighborhood. And it was full of African Americans and immigrants, including my ancestors, which were German Russians. So they were all living together in harmony. And also part of this, I don't know, if we could talk for hours on this, but one of the picture you're looking at right now, which of course people can't see.
Yeah, I opened your book to page 60. There's a photograph of some black children.
There is a white kid on the side. And so that shows you it's an integrated neighborhood. The picture is of a family group, children, but this kid way off to the side wasn't intended to be in the final photograph because it would have gotten cropped out. But it's a good thing she is, because she is probably a German-Russian kid. And also part of the process of this was across the street was a guy, a white family, and I have spoken at length to the guy that lived in that house. And he lives in Southern California.
And these pictures, a lot of them are outdoors. So these kids are in front of a house, standing in front of the porch. This young, fair-skinned, fair-haired little girl is looking at them. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a little girl. So three of them are standing, of the children in the photograph. There's a young boy sitting in a chair with a child in his lap that looks like a beautiful little girl.
Right. It's actually a little boy, because the style within all cultures back then was you dress the girls and boys in the same clothes for the first couple of years of their lives. That we have identified everybody in that photograph, which is just that's just incredible to be able to reach back 100 years and figure out who these people are. The little baby Lonnie Thomas, and he became a championship golfer in Nebraska, a black man, and
which was very unusual. I mean,
very
even
unusual.
Tiger Woods,
yeah.
People thought were shocked at that.
Yeah, and this was in the
1930s. And here's this young little black kid that becomes a championship golfer.
And then his daughter, Deborah Thomas, becomes a singer in L.A., and she has performed with Lionel Richie, Dionne Warwick, and a whole list of A performers. And I've interviewed her at length, and she has some incredible photographs herself. So, I mean, this really is a great treasure hunt. I mean, sometimes it's very frustrating because you think you get close to something,
comes to a dead end, or what seems like a dead end.
Right, yeah. And other times, like the other day, somebody calls me up, and he says, my name is Walter Colley, and my father.
Now that sounds familiar, because the cover photograph.
Yeah, and he was on my website, because I have all the photos on my website, and he said there's a number of pictures of people with furs on. Muffs. And vests and collars and stuff. He said my father made those. It's just all of these little things. So one of the great things about having these now on the national stage at the Smithsonian is that more people hopefully will see them. And because, the clock is running.
These people are getting older.
Yeah, I mean, there's nobody.
Not the adults that were in these photographs,
but children.
Their children are getting older, and the grandchildren are getting older. And so the clock is ticking for you to solve some of these mysteries.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot of mysteries, but there's a lot of rewards too. I mean, the things we found. I mean, one of the first pictures that was published was in Newsweek magazine, and somebody saw that picture of a bunch of kids on the bicycle, and he was the man that saw the picture was a radiologist in Atlanta. He saw that and recognized it as his father, the little kid. And so that opened doors. We found they were Lebanese Americans. So once again, it was a really good time piece, time stamp of that neighborhood, that immigrant neighborhood in Lincoln, Nebraska, where everybody was living in pretty good harmony.
My guest is Douglas Keister, and his book, his collection of photographs, were published in the Images of America series, Lincoln, because these photographs were Lincoln, Nebraska, Lincoln in Black and White. And you have a photograph in the first page of your book, really, that is not a part of the other chapters. And I was wondering why you put a hairdresser on the very first. I mean, it's an elegant photograph, and I love her dress. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
And her hat.
It's a woman on a porch.
Leona Dean, right. Hairdresser.
And she is, like you said, it's such a brilliantly composed
Isn't
photograph.
It?
I mean, this is a professional doing this. This is not some snapshot. I love it because she's reading a book.
Yes.
And that is another great example of the New Negro Movement. It was all about education and elevation. And that photograph says it all. I've actually used this photograph, and I've paired it up with an Oprah Winfrey quote about it was reading that got her out of her circumstances. And so I think that picture and that quote should be in every school in America. But, I'm not in charge. But it should be. So
yeah, to show this elegant young woman reading a book. She's sitting on a porch, perfectly lit, composed. And so are so many of these photographs.
Yeah. A number of photographs have people with books. And that says a lot. I mean, it's the old picture is worth a thousand words, and that they each tell their own little story.
And the fact there's so many outdoors, I'm surprised that the lighting is so well done when you're photographing outdoors.
Yeah, and so that once again, the photographer knew what he was doing. I mean, they're all photographed in the shade, which is where you want to take portraits of people outdoors. You don't want bright sun.
Squinting in the sun. Mm-hmm.
And to be able to figure out the exposure without an exposure meter, to figure all that stuff out, I mean, this is a professional at work. Even though his real job, his paying job was a janitor. So he was not, he didn't have like a shingle out that said John Johnson photographer. This is something he did for the community on his own.
Well, some of the photographs include dogs.
Yeah.
And that seems very realistic. There's one with this delightful young boy with this smile on his face. He's got a dog on each side. He's flanked by two very well-mannered dogs.
And if you look at it real closely, it's such a natural photograph because his little sweater is his button crooked. Button crooked.
The sweater is misbuttoned.
Yeah. But that gives it an authenticity. It's not tremendously posed. It's posed just enough. And the photographer had enough good sense to say, leave it, because that's a kid. That's a great photograph of a kid.
And that's also one of the reasons that if I were looking at, or when I did look at these photographs in the exhibit on the Chico State campus, I could stand in front of one single photograph for the longest time because there's so many details that would be delightful, surprising, enigmatic.
Yeah, and once again, because we have the original negatives, we can blow them up, and you can see all the details. You can see what people are reading. They see what, wedding invitations, the print on them. You can see what people are eating. The wealth of detail is just incredible.
And here you have just a house, the Johnson House on A Street in Lincoln, Nebraska.
That was another key because we were able to zoom in on it and see the address. And Ed Zimmer, once again, I have to give him tremendous credit, has access to the city directories. And he was able to determine, yes, that's the Johnson House. That was built by Harrison Johnson, his father, who was the only black soldier in an all-white regiment in a Civil War. I mean, just little things like that give it such an authenticity and a realism.
Yeah, because you mentioned that a couple of them were former slaves.
Yes.
And Civil War veterans. Mm-hmm. And we don't think of maybe a Black Regiment one, but such a rarity.
Yeah.
And yet here these were Civil War veterans.
Matter of fact, there's another, the guy that I mentioned lived across the street from one of the photographs, has done a tremendous amount of research into some of the Black soldiers that were from the Nebraska Regiment and also the Kansas Regiment. So that's, once again, you got this other person kind of unrelated directly to the photographs, but he's doing a tremendous amount of research. Stan Schmuck is his name, Schmuck.
You even include a little bit of the history of the town itself. It wasn't originally named Lincoln.
Yeah, it was Lancaster. Yeah, and with little tidbits like that kind of give it that, you know, a little more readability and the history part of it, and a little bit about the university and, you know, how it is today. And it's been an incredible 50-year journey.
And you mentioned that, speaking of University of Nebraska, and you said that John Johnson played football.
Yes.
For the University of Nebraska.
Yeah. The photographer played football while he was there at the University of Nebraska. He was attended for a couple of years. Once again, this was during the New Negro Movement, which was about 1900 till about the Great Depression. And it was, becoming very integrated, And then when the Great Depression hit, all that changed. And
because it took years later before, say, football teams were integrated.
Right. The football team became segregated, where there was these great strides being made during the New Negro Movement, and it all came crashing down during the Depression.
You mentioned that some of these photographs that you particularly like, you like the one of the hairdresser, and there's a photograph of the mother and son, and it seems like I remember that was rather prominent in your exhibit at the university.
Yes, we selected this one of it's a mother on the porch with her son, and she's holding his head. Mm-hmm. She's got this great big smile. She's actually moving a little bit, and he is dead.
He doesn't look too happy.
He's not too happy. And once again, by being able to zoom in on it, we can actually see the streaks of tears on his face. You can just barely see it in the small picture, but on the large picture, you can see these little white, salt, of dried tears. So, but it's called, Mother's Loving Touch. And so, she's comforting him.
And you can just create your own story about, why is he sad? He wanted to go play with his friends. Yeah. Maybe his mother said, no, son, you've got to get this picture. Who knows what she's got the smile on her face and this comforting. And that's where you can see a little bit like her hand move because it's slightly blurred. Yeah. So maybe she was patting his
cheek. But he's dead still. He's not moving.
And she has high-button shoes on.
Yeah. Oh, it's just the dress of some of these photographs are just incredible.
Well, this is just such a delight that all these photographs are gathered in this book, Images of America, Lincoln in Black and White, 1910 to 1925. So for people who can't make it to Washington, D.C., a lot of people do go to Washington, and I think they'll want to put this on their itinerary to see this museum.
Right. One of the things I should mention is the Smithsonian exhibits maybe 1% of what they actually have, but these photographs are in multiple exhibits. So really quite an honor, and they will continue to be on multiple exhibits as time goes on.
Well, I certainly enjoyed looking at your photographs, Doug. Thank you.
Thank you.
After a break, I'll be talking to retired English teacher Kathy Chase about her novel, Jump. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Before becoming an English teacher at Butte College, Kathy Chase worked in law enforcement as a liaison for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. It was her job to protect the victim and make sure there was a connection between them and the judicial system. Her own personal experience with domestic violence as a child gave her unique insight into their situations. She volunteers at the Esplanade House in Chico, helping give adult job skills and helping with their job search. She's also on the board of the North State Writers. Kathy Chase has retired from teaching at Butte College and has written a short story called My Tortured Friend and a young adult contemporary novel that highlights the problems of domestic violence and its effects on children. And the title of that book is Jump. Kathy Chase, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, that seems like an odd career combination, law enforcement and teaching English. How did you get involved in law enforcement?
Well, actually, I got involved in law enforcement because when my father had passed away, the gentleman or the officer who had come to the house to tell us that he had passed in his car was a longtime friend. And over the years, we had kept in touch. And when I turned 21, they were advertising for a police dispatcher. And he called me and said, I think you'd be really good at it. And started a 25-year career.
Now, you just said that your actual father died in a car accident?
Well, it wasn't an accident. He actually was on his way to work, and he felt a heart attack coming on, and he pulled over to the side of the road and passed away.
My goodness. Because in your novel, the young woman, Nona, her dad is deceased, but it was under suspicious circumstances.
Right, because this novel, I wanted to send a message to the readers, but I also wanted it to be interesting and be an adventure. So I had to change a little bit, change things around so that there was some mystery going on.
Well, it seems like law enforcement and teaching English are so far apart, but once I learned more about your situation, I saw, oh, no, they complement each other.
Yeah.
And so how does your teaching English, how did that grow out of? How's that connected to your involvement in law enforcement?
I think it's because I dealt so many times with victims, and I saw some kind of improvement in their lives as they were helped through the system. And I've always liked teaching and being involved with people. And it just seemed like a normal thing to do. When I was 38, I decided I wanted to change careers. And I went back to college and got my bachelor's and then my master's and started teaching English or add to ESL students, which is English second language students, the immigrants.
So your career as a dispatcher began more or less age 21?
Yes.
And then at 38, you decided to go back to college and become an English teacher. You must have been somewhat unusual in your class of other people who want to teach English, who want to teach literature. Probably.
Yes.
And here you are wanting to teach skills.
Exactly.
And was that your intention? Is that why you chose English as your major?
Yes, that's correct. I wanted to give people the ability to improve their lives and being able to speak the language that they're living in. And
So you chose English as a second language.
That was my master's, was linguistics, and English as a second language. So that was my focus. That's what I wanted to do, was improve their lives. I mean, when you think about the bravery it takes to come to another country and not be able to speak the language and have your family with you and try to make a life worth living for you and your family, it's a tremendous task, and I just think they should be rewarded for what they've done. And English, since that's what I knew, English seemed to be the logical step for me.
My guest is Kathy Chase. She is retired from teaching English now, but she continues to stay involved with helping people write. And you mentioned English as a foreign language. That you taught here in the United States, but you also spent time in Europe?
Yes, that was a dream. Since my BA is in history and social science, I love history. And I'm a child of the Cold War. And so I grew up thinking everybody in the USSR was trying to kill us. You know, I mean, that's what we were told.
Absolutely.
So
they were our enemy.
Right. So when I graduated with my BA, I happened to walk into the student services, and there on the wall was a sign that said English teachers needed in Czechoslovakia. It was 1992. The wall, USSR had dissolved like 6 months before. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is exactly perfect for me. So I applied, and that was in April, and in September I was on my way.
To Czechoslovakia.
Czechoslovakia. I spent 2 years there. I was there when it changed and split from the Czech Republic to the Slovak Republic. And it was wonderful. I got to travel. I backpack, and every weekend I'd get on the train and just go somewhere.
So what an exciting time to be in Czechoslovakia.
Oh, it was. And the people were wonderful. You know, it was very different. In fact, it reminded me of the 1950s when I grew up, because they were so disconnected with the rest of the world that when they finally had some freedom to travel and things like that. So I was there when they were still wearing gloves and hats and pushing baby trams, and it was very homey, and people were very friendly.
And I would think they would be very motivated to learn English.
Oh, yes. Oh.
So you had eager students.
Oh, well, not even that. It would take me an hour to go to the store, because I was an anomaly in this town. There were 20,000 people, and nobody had ever met an American. So everybody knew who I was. And I would walk into a store, and people would walk up to me and say, oh, you're the English teacher. And then they'd start talking to me, you know, and they'd ask me questions. Why do you say this, and why do you say that? And so it would take me forever just to go downtown, because everybody wanted to speak to me. A friend of mine said, when you leave here, you're going to be very disappointed, because you won't be a movie star in America.
No, I was thinking about a doctor at a party, and people coming up saying, well, doctor, I've got this ache in my shoulder. And so they were coming, how do you say this in English, or why do you say that in English?
Exactly. It was constant. You know, it was great. I loved it.
Well, was their level of English such that they could write compositions and express themselves like you might people who already speak English?
Well, my students, I taught the advanced group. Over there, they have to take four languages from early on.
Four languages.
And when I got there, they did. They had to take their own, and they had to take Russian.
Russian, I'm sure.
And then they could pick between French, Spanish, and English. So some of my students had been taking English for like 8-9 years. Now, they had never spoken to a native speaker. So this was quite an exciting thing for them. So I taught the advanced students. So their writing was not bad, actually. In fact, some of them were better than our native-borns.
My guest is Kathy Chase, and she is retired from teaching English now, but she spent time teaching English as a foreign language in Europe. So when you come back from Czechoslovakia, there was a chance now to do something maybe new, take a different direction in your career. Did you do that, or what did you do when you got back?
Well, I finished my master's, and then I got hired on at Butte College, and I ran the program called Vocational ESL Program, which they don't have anymore, but we have for 10 years. I taught English to immigrants, but it also has vocation involved, so I would teach them job skills, set up training programs, and then go out and contact employers and attach the employers to the students. And then I would follow them for 6 months to make sure everything was going well. Some of my students I had for 4 years, because they came to me with no English skills. And at the end of 4 years, my first group, and this was the Hmong group that was sent over from the concentration camps in Thailand. At the end of the 4 years, when 5 years came up, every one of my students became a citizen. And everyone was working. And since then, most of them have bought homes. And I'm very proud of them. They work so hard.
How do you even begin when they come into your class? What is the first kind of assignment that you give them? I mean, you can't just say, okay, let's write a job resume now.
Well, we worked on the English first. I mean, they obviously, there are very few jobs that you can do that you can't.
If you don't
can't,
speak yeah, English.
If you can't speak English. So the first year was really on being able to converse and hold some kind of conversation. After that, then we would work on job skills. We worked in things as silly as it seems, like how do you stand in line at a grocery store? You know, how do you read your PG&E bill?
Well, you know, speaking of standing in line, because we here in the United States tend to take that for granted. We expect if we get in line at the grocery store that you proceed in an orderly manner. And I've lived in other countries where if you leave a couple of inches between yourself and the person in front of you, somebody just says, oh, I'll just step right in here.
Exactly, exactly. And you could cause a fight here in the United States if you do that.
That just isn't done here.
Right. So you have to, there's a lot of little nuances that you have to teach people to be able to survive without angering the native people.
Well, it sounds like maybe you took them on field trips.
Oh, it was wonderful. We went to San Francisco. They'd never seen the ocean, and we rented three vans, and there were 22 of them. Me and another teacher, Tina Day, who's wonderful, and she helped me, and we went through the museums, and We went on a sightseeing boat out in the bay, and we went to Fort Point. And then the second time we went to Chinatown. And we did all kinds of things together. Plus, we would go on field trips here in town. We would go out to a store and have them talk and buy things. And when they first got here, none of them had coats, and they got here in September. And there was no money to buy coats. So one of the first things we did is we went to thrift stores and looked through the coats, and they bought coats for themselves and their children.
I would think, too, that from your point of view, there are things that you don't even realize that they don't know. So it was also a learning experience for you.
Exactly. Well, one of my students came, and they were sponsored by an older relative. But they were put in an apartment, and they were kind of just left because the other person was working. And it was almost a week before they realized that they didn't know what a toilet was, because in the concentration camp they didn't have toilets. So they were drinking the water out of the tank in the toilet, not the toilet, but the tank.
The tank.
Because they didn't know where to get the water. So it's basics that, you know, they were really. It was a very sad thing to see. These people had spent 25 years in these camps after Laos.
It's just so hard for us to imagine.
I know. They had no, in these camps, they had no running water. They had no toilets, no schools. So it was very.
My guest is retired English teacher Kathy Chase, and she has taught English as a foreign language, and she taught, really, you taught American culture.
Exactly.
It sounds like
exactly.
To these students before you could, or while you were teaching them English, they had to learn the culture.
Exactly.
And what is considered acceptable in this culture and what is not, so that they could make themselves employable.
Well, that and be good citizens. They were here for good. They weren't going back.
And so you were able to give them hope.
Yes, absolutely. And that was my main impetus, was to give them, for them to decide that they had good self-esteem, that they could get a goal, work towards that goal, and that goal could be realized.
Well, you still, I say you retired from teaching English from Butte College, but you still help people with their writing skills, don't you? You are a volunteer at the Esplanade House in Chico.
Well, yeah, there I teach job readiness class.
You might explain to people who don't know what the Esplanade House is.
Well, the Esplanade House is a quite a nice apartment complex that's run by the state that people who have had drug problems or domestic violence issues, people that are on the road to recovery, they come there and they can live for up to 2 years. And they have certain programs they have to take, and they have to abide by very strict rules. And once they graduate, then they will have a job. So I usually take the two-year people and teach them resumes, how to look for jobs, how to interview, how to dress appropriately for a job interview, and things like that.
So you, there's no creative writing involved here. It's all very
resume,
practical.
Yes, very resume mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. Yes.
Get them job ready.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you find that people think that there it is possible for them to get employed, or they had such a history that they're maybe hopeless? How do you inspire them to think, yes, you can do this?
Well, by the time I get them, they're pretty inspired because they've been working very hard.
So the ones that are less motivated have kind of fallen.
Well, they drop out, because they're very strict there. And most of them did not have their children. They were taken away from them. So since they've come to this program, they've gotten their children back. So they're very motivated to continue. So we just work towards their goals, what they want. People would be surprised at how many skills you have, even in a small job like parking cars. I mean, you know, you have skills of meeting people, you have timetable, time limits, you have organizational skills, all these. So when you take apart what they've done in the past and start picking out the different things they know, you'd be surprised how much they have.
And I'll bet they are surprised, too.
They are, yeah.
Well, I mentioned that you have written a novel, and this is intended for middle school, young adult, your book that you wrote. But when I was reading it, I was saying, gosh, so many of us need to read this, not just people the age of the characters in your book. Do you find that that people beyond that age group that this book is intended for, do they read this book?
Oh, yes. I've had a lot of adults read the book. In fact, not too long ago, a couple of days ago, a person I know called me and was emotionally involved in the book because it was so much like her real life. And she was very grateful that somebody had written it down and shown that there can be life after domestic violence.
Well, it's so alien to any of my personal experience, but yet it seemed very believable, very true to life. How were you able to create a story that seems so believable?
Well, because the first three chapters are autobiographical. When I grew up, I had a stepfather who was emotionally abusive. And one of the reasons I wrote it is I probably had to get it out myself. So almost all of the things that happened between him and I in the book are real life. They did happen.
Mm-hmm. Because I know that you have personal experience with this sort of thing that is the theme in your book. So as I was reading it, I was wondering, okay, where is that line? Where is the Nona, the character mm-hmm. in the book? How does her experience overlap yours, Kathy's experience, and where do they diverge? So you're saying that the beginning part of this book is really taken from your own life.
Exactly. And I wanted to write an adventure. And the adventure part of it is that something it took me years to find out, because with domestic violence, you have a very low self-esteem. And you tend to blame yourself. Must be something I'm doing, especially when you're young. And I was 11 when he came into our life.
So you were a little bit younger than where you pick up the story in your book.
Exactly. But it took me into my 20s till I realized that, wait a minute, this wasn't me. It was him, and I'm a good person. And
it wasn't your fault.
It wasn't my fault. And that's what I wanted to get across in the book. Even though it's at 15, she's learning these things. She's learning that she's strong and that she doesn't have poor self-esteem. She can change that. And she can be successful. She's learning it younger than I did. But I wanted to show the adventure of her going through that process.
So you kind of compressed the timetable.
Exactly.
Well, let's meet your main character. Kathy, if you would begin just chapter one in your book and read us that beginning.
Okay. The bedroom door opens quietly. Only a sliver of light from the hall penetrates the darkened room. I close my eyes tightly, knowing he's coming to me again. The sound of his staggering, muffled footsteps on the carpet let me know he's close to my bedside. The odor of sweat and stale beer reaches me before I hear his gruff, garbled whisper. I shrink back deeper into my bed, slowly pulling the blanket over my head, trying to disappear. My heart's pounding so loud I know he can hear my heartbeat. He leans down, touching my hair with his lips, and whispers into my ear, "You can't hide from me. I'm always here to watch you. You think you're so important, the little princess. I tell you, don't go to sleep tonight because I'm going to kill you." With his usual throaty chuckle, he stands up and slowly retraces his steps to the door. He opens it and quietly closes it behind him. Although the room is warm, I shiver from deep inside and feel my stomach tighten. My head wants to explode. My breath is coming in short gasps. On the other side of the room, Emma moves restlessly. I know she's awake and listening. Her tiny voice floats through the darkness. "It's going to be okay, Nona. He doesn't mean it. Anyway, Mom would stop him if he acts crazy."
My guest is Kathy Chase, and she's reading from her novel, Jump. And it also has a subtitle, Chase Your Dreams. Now, the two characters we meet here, Nona, the one who is the narrator who is speaking, and then her younger sister, Emma.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so shocking when you're the reader and you read along and this person comes in and say, "I tell you, don't go to sleep tonight because I'm going to kill you." And Kathy, you just said that this is based on your life.
Yes.
Did this man say those words to you?
Yes, he did.
And you're
and then he laughed.
And you were only 11 years old.
I know. It was tremendous. I mean, it was very hard. But
and was there anybody you could tell? Because I'm guessing that your mother was like the mother in this book. She thinks everything's fine.
Well, my mother, to her benefit, she had been married to my father 18 years, had a wonderful marriage, and she had known Frank, this man,
mm-hmm.
Since she was a child, and he was fine. She didn't know about him. And then I kept everything a secret because I knew he could be abusive to her, so I wanted to protect her. So I didn't tell her.
What was really happening.
And on the other side of that, my mother was a warm, cheerful, loving person, and she wanted everybody to be happy. You know, I can remember her constantly asking me, "Are you happy today?" "Oh, yeah, Ma, we're fine," you know. So, no, I didn't tell her, and she had no idea what was going on.
So this person tells you, threatens you,
mm-hmm.
you and the character in your book. And what I'd like you to read now is a section in your book about this. The title is Jump. And mm-hmm. Judy, when I saw this title, I thought, Jump, what does that mean? Because I was thinking, okay, jump has a meaning. It's a verb, like you jump rope, you jump over a log. And then I discover, well, I'm not the only one puzzled by this term, because when I continue in your book, I say, oh, the characters in your book don't know what that means.
Exactly, exactly.
So can we pick up a little later in your book where Nona, and she has a couple of friends,
mm-hmm.
and this is on page 13, and if you would pick up there, they're wondering what's wrong with their friend Jana.
Yeah, Jana is her girlfriend, and Spence is her boyfriend.
A friend.
Yeah. What's wrong with Jana? Her Uncle John disappeared yesterday, and they have looked everywhere. They can't find him. What do you mean he disappeared? He just left town or what? I don't know. I turned sideways in the seat and looked at her. Can I ask you something? Sure, what is it? Jana's dad said something funny. He asked her grandma if she thought that Uncle John had jumped. When Jan asked her dad what jump meant, he just said that wasn't any of her business. She knows that isn't true. We need to know what jump means. Looking down and clutching the steering wheel as if to steady herself, she responds in a sharp, lowered voice, I don't know. It doesn't mean anything. Mom, I plead, come on. What's the big secret? If you don't tell me, I'll find out anyway.
Kathy Chase is reading from her novel aimed at young adults. The title of the novel is Jump. And on your cover, you say it's written by a survivor. So we can guess that up to a point, this is autobiographical. But this about this strange jump, now, is this from your imagination?
It's from a dream, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had a dream one night about going somewhere else by transporter. And I woke up and I thought, that's an interesting idea. So I sat down and started fiddling with it, you know, thinking about it. And so that's how this came about, that there's a government program that where they take undesirables and they transport them literally in a transporter to another place and wipe their memories. And they turn them into someone who is more acceptable. And so that's where jumping comes from.
So at this point, because this is from your imagination, you can tell this story without offending anyone. But this previous, the story that comes from your own life, is anybody going to be upset by what you wrote, since you say this is autobiographical?
No. It's they're both passed away. Well, they passed away, so it would be fine.
So you can tell this story because it is your story and without upsetting anybody
else. Right.
Well, we learned that this uncle, they're wondering, where is this uncle? And we learned that he's not dead, but what has happened to this guy?
Well, the government has taken him and sent him someplace else in this transporter. The kids find out about it. And Nona, who doesn't feel she's...
The
15-year-old. She feels she's not necessary at home. Decides to jump after him to find him.
Well, you also have her saying to her friend, Jana, I think the government had something to do with what happened to your uncle, because she's getting nothing from her mother's not telling her what's going on and what that means. Mm-hmm. But she starts putting information together and figuring out why this uncle of her friend disappeared. And they... And this is a story that couldn't, 20 years ago, they wouldn't have Googled it. But nowadays, that's what young people do. If they don't understand a term, they look it up on Google. And in the story, she takes her phone out of her pocket and she puts in jumping, anything that might bring it up. And there's jump rope, jumping jacks, jumpers, but no jump. Mm-hmm. And so then they're really intrigued, because if it isn't on the internet, the government must be keeping this top secret.
Absolutely. Everything's on the internet.
So they are wondering, well, how do they do that? And so they think maybe they should go to the police. And your heroine, Jana, no, we can't go to anybody. They're the government. We can't trust any adult. I just told you that.
Exactly.
So did you come to feel like you couldn't trust adults?
When I was a kid, yeah, because you want to. Well, it wasn't that I didn't trust them. I just thought that the ramifications would come back to hurt my mother. Remember my father had died and they'd had a wonderful relationship.
Wanted to protect your mother?
I wanted to protect her. She was a very wonderful person, so.
Well, it really is a story that I'm glad you wrote. And I hope people will take an opportunity to learn more about domestic violence, sexual assault, which wasn't the case in your case, but you do have written a book that will be helpful to people in this situation.
I hope so. I hope they come away with, my main idea is that if you believe in yourself, if you set a goal, it can be a small goal, something very tiny, even getting a new job, passing a test, doesn't matter, but you work towards that goal, you can be happy and successful. That's what the book's about.
Thank you, Kathy. My guest has been Kathy Chase, and her novel, aimed at young adults, but also for adults. The title of the book is Jump.
Thank you.
I would also like to thank my first guest, Douglas Keister, whose photographs of people and places in Lincoln, Nebraska, are now on display in the newly opened National Museum of African American History and Culture. If you want more information on Kathy Chase's book, look under her name rather than the book's title, Jump. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.